in a slightly different way. So the best protection comes from a diet containing as many different phytochemicals as possible. Rule number 26. Drink the spinach water. Here's another bit of traditional wisdom with good science behind it. The water in which vegetables are cooked is rich in vitamins and other healthful plant chemicals. Save it for soup or add it to sauces. Rule number 27. Eat animals that have themselves eaten well. The diet of the animals we eat strongly influences the nutritional quality and healthfulness of the food we get from them, whether it is meat or milk or eggs. This should be self-evident, yet it is a truth routinely overlooked by the industrial food chain in its quest to produce vast quantities of cheap animal protein. That quest has changed the diet of most of our food animals in ways that have often damaged their health and healthfulness. We feed animals a high-energy diet of grain to make them grow quickly, even in the case of ruminants that have evolved to eat grass. But even food animals that can tolerate grain are much healthier when they have access to green plants, and so, it turns out, are their meat and eggs. The food from these animals will contain much healthier types of fat, more omega-3s, less omega-6s, as well as appreciably higher levels of vitamins and antioxidants. For the same reason, meat from wild animals is particularly nutritious. Check out rule number 31. It's worth looking for pastured animal foods in the market and paying the premium prices they typically command if you can. Rule number 28. If you have the space, buy a freezer. When you find a good source of pastured meat, you'll want to buy it in quantity. Buying meat in bulk, a quarter of a steer, say, or a whole hog, is one way to eat well on a budget. Dedicated freezers are surprisingly inexpensive to buy and to operate because they aren't open nearly as often as the one in your refrigerator. A freezer will also enable you to put up food from the farmer's market and encourage you to buy produce in bulk at the height of its season when it will be most abundant and therefore cheapest. And freezing does not significantly diminish the nutritional value of produce. Rule number 29. Eat like an omnivore. Whether or not you eat any animal foods, it's a good idea to try to add some new species, and not just new foods, to your diet. That is, new kinds of plants, animals, and fungi. The dazzling diversity of food products on offer in the supermarket is deceptive because so many of them are made from the same small handful of plant species. And most of those, the corn and soy and wheat, are seeds rather than leaves. The greater the diversity of species you eat, the more likely you are to cover all your nutritional bases. Rule number 30. Eat well-grown food from healthy soil. It would have been easier to say, eat organic, and it is true that food certified organic is usually well grown in relatively healthy soil, soil nourished by organic matter rather than chemical fertilizers. It also will contain little or no residue from synthetic pesticides or pharmaceuticals. Yet there are exceptional farmers and ranchers in America who, for one reason or another, are not certified organic, and the excellent food they grow should not be overlooked. And just because a food is labeled organic does not mean it's good for you. Organic soda is still soda, a large quantity of utterly empty calories. We now have a body of research supporting the hypothesis first advanced by organic pioneers Sir Albert Howard and J.I. Rodale that soils rich in organic matter produce more nutritious food, that is, food with higher levels of antioxidants, flavonoids, vitamins, and minerals. Of course, after a few days riding cross-country in a truck, the nutritional quality of any kind of produce will deteriorate. So ideally, you want to eat food that is both organic and local. Rule number 31. Eat wild foods when you can. Two of the most nutritious plants in the world, lamb's quarters and purslane, are weeds, and some of the healthiest traditional diets, like the Mediterranean, make frequent use of wild greens. The fields and forests are crowded with plants containing higher levels of various phytochemicals than their domesticated cousins. Why? Because these plants have to defend themselves against pests and diseases without any help from us. And because historically we've tended to select and breed crop plants for sweetness. Many of the defensive compounds plants produce are bitter. We also breed for shelf life, and so have unwittingly selected for plants with low levels of omega-3 fatty acids, since these fats quickly oxidize or turn rancid. Wild animals and fish, too, are worth adding to your diet when you have the opportunity. Wild game generally has less saturated and more healthy fats than domesticated animals, because most of these wild animals themselves eat a diverse diet of plants rather than grain. Rule number 32. Don't overlook the oily little fishes. Wild fish are among the healthiest things you can eat, yet many wild fish stocks are on the verge of collapse because of overfishing. Avoid big fish at the top of the marine food chain, tuna, swordfish, shark, because they're endangered and because they often contain high levels of mercury. Fortunately, a few of the most nutritious wild fish species, including mackerel, sardines, and anchovies, are well managed and in some cases are even abundant. Those oily little fish are particularly good choices. According to a Dutch proverb, a land with lots of herring can get along with few doctors. Rule number 33. Eat some foods that have been pre-digested by bacteria or fungi. Many traditional cultures swear by the health benefits of fermented foods, foods that have been transformed by live microorganisms such as yogurt, sauerkraut, soy sauce, kimchi, and sourdough bread. These foods can be a good source of vitamin B12, an essential nutrient you can't get from plants. B12 is produced by animals and bacteria. Many fermented foods also contain probiotics, beneficial bacteria that research suggests improve the function of the digestive and immune systems and, according to some studies, help reduce allergic reactions and inflammation. Rule number 34. Sweeten and salt your food yourself. Whether soups or cereals or soft drinks, foods and beverages that have been prepared by corporations contain far higher levels of salt and sugar than any ordinary human would ever add, even a child. By sweetening and salting these foods yourself, you'll make them to your taste, and you will find you're consuming a fraction as much sugar and salt as you otherwise would. Rule number 35. Eat sweet foods as you find them in nature. In nature, sugars almost always come packaged with fiber, which slows their absorption and gives you a sense of satiety before you've ingested too many calories. That's why you're always better off eating the fruit rather than drinking its juice. In general, calories taken in liquid form are more fattening because they don't make us feel full. Humans are one of the very few mammals that obtain calories from liquids after weaning. So don't drink your sweets, and remember, there is no such thing as a healthy soda. Rule number 36. Don't eat breakfast cereals that change the color of the milk. This should go without saying. Such cereals are highly processed and full of refined carbohydrates as well as chemical additives. Rule number 37. The whiter the bread, the sooner you'll be dead. This rather blunt bit of cross-cultural grandmotherly advice, passed down from both Jewish and Italian grandmothers, suggests that the health risks of white flour have been popularly recognized for many years. As far as the body is concerned, white flour is not much different from sugar. Unless supplemented, it offers none of the good things in whole grains like fiber, B vitamins, and healthy fats. It's little more than a shot of glucose. Large spikes of glucose are inflammatory and wreak havoc on our insulin metabolism. Eat whole grains and minimize your consumption of white flour. Recent research indicates that the grandmothers who lived by this rule were right. People who eat lots of whole grains tend to be healthier and to live longer. Rule number 38. favor the kinds of oils and grains that have traditionally been stone ground. When grindstones were the only way to refine flour and oil were generally more nutritious. In the case of grain, more of the germ and fiber remains when it is ground on a stone. You can't get white flour from a stone. The nutritional benefits of whole grains are impressive. Fiber, the full range of B vitamins, and healthy oils, all of which are sacrificed when the grain is refined on modern roller mills. As I just mentioned, highly refined flours are little different from sugar. And the newer oils that are extracted by modern chemical means tend to have less favorable fatty acid profiles and more additives than olive, sesame, palm fruit, and peanut oils that have been obtained the old-fashioned way. Rule number 39. Eat all the junk food you want as long as you cook it yourself. There is nothing wrong with eating sweets, fried foods, pastries, even drinking a soda every now and then, but food manufacturers have made eating these formerly expensive and hard-to-make treats so cheap and easy that we're eating them every day. The French fry did not become America's most popular vegetable until industry took over the jobs of washing, peeling, cutting, and frying the potatoes and cleaning up the mess. If you made all the French fries you ate, you would eat them much less often, if only because they're so much work. The same holds true for fried chicken, chips, cakes, pies, and ice cream. Enjoy these treats as often as you're willing to prepare them. Chances are good it won't be every day. Rule number 40. Be the kind of person who takes supplements, and then skip the supplements. We know that people who take supplements are generally healthier than the rest of us, and we also know that in controlled studies, most of the supplements they take don't appear to be effective. How can this be? Supplement takers are healthy for reasons that have nothing to do with the pills. They're typically more health-conscious, better educated, and more affluent. They're also more likely to exercise and to eat whole grains. So to the extent you can, be the kind of person who would take supplements and then save your money. There are exceptions to this rule for people who have a specific nutrient deficiency or are older than 50. As we age, our need for antioxidants increases while our body's ability to absorb them from the diet declines. And if you don't eat much fish, it couldn't hurt to take a fish oil supplement, too. Rule number 41. Eat more like the French, or the Japanese, or the Italians, or the Greeks. People who eat according to the rules of a traditional food culture are generally healthier than those of us eating a modern Western diet of processed food. Any traditional diet will do. If it were not a healthy diet, the people who follow it wouldn't still be around. True, food cultures are embedded in societies and economies and ecologies, and some of them travel better than others. Inuit, not so well as Italian. In borrowing from a food culture, pay attention to how a culture eats as well as to what it eats. In the case of the French paradox, for example, it may not be the dietary nutrients that keep the French healthy, lots of saturated fats and white flour, as much as their food habits, small portions eaten at leisurely communal meals, no second helpings or snacking. Pay attention, too, to the combinations of foods in traditional cultures. In Latin America, corn is traditionally cooked with lime and eaten with beans. What would otherwise be a nutritionally deficient staple becomes the basis of a healthy, balanced diet. The beans supply amino acids lacking in corn, and the lime makes niacin available. Cultures that took corn from Latin America without the beans or the lime wound up with serious nutritional deficiencies, such as pellagra. Traditional diets are more than the sum of their food parts. Rule number 42. Regard non-traditional foods with skepticism. Innovation is always interesting, but when it comes to food, it pays to approach new creations with caution. If diets are the products of an evolutionary process in which groups of people adapt to the plants, animals, and fungi a particular place has to offer, then a novel food or culinary innovation resembles a mutation, It might represent an evolutionary improvement, but chances are it doesn't. Soy products offer a good case in point. People have been eating soy in the form of tofu, soy sauce, and tempeh for many generations, but today we're eating novelties like soy protein isolate, soy isoflavones, and textured vegetable protein from soy, and partially hydrogenated soy oils, and there are questions about the healthfulness of these new food products. As a senior FDA scientist has written, quote, "Confidence that soy products are safe is clearly based more on belief than hard data," unquote. Until we have that data, you're probably better off eating soy prepared in the traditional Asian manner than according to the novel recipes dreamed up by food scientists. Rule number 43. Have a glass of wine with dinner. Wine may not be the magic bullet in the French or Mediterranean diet, but it does seem to be an integral part of these dietary patterns. There is now considerable scientific evidence for the health benefits of alcohol to go with a few centuries of traditional belief and anecdotal evidence. Mindful of the social and health effects of alcoholism, public health authorities are loath to recommend drinking. But the fact is that people who drink moderately and regularly live longer and suffer considerably less heart disease than teetotalers. Alcohol of any kind appears to reduce the risk of heart disease, but the polyphenols in red wine, resveratrol in particular, may have unique protective qualities. Most experts recommend no more than 2 drinks a day for men, 1 for women. Also, the health benefits of alcohol may depend as much on the pattern of drinking as on the amount. Drinking a little every day is better than drinking a lot on the weekends, and drinking with food is better than drinking without it. Someday, science may figure out the complex synergies at work in a traditional diet that includes wine, but until then, we can marvel at its accumulated wisdom and raise a glass to paradox. Part 3. How should I eat? Not too much. The rules in the previous 2 sections deal primarily with questions about what to eat. The ones in this section deal with something a bit more elusive, but no less important: the set of manners, eating habits, taboos, and unspoken guidelines that together govern a person's and a culture's relationship to food and eating. How you eat may have as much bearing on your health and your weight as what you eat. This may well be the deeper lesson of the so-called French paradox, the mystery, at least to nutritionists, of a population that eats all sorts of supposedly lethal fatty foods and washes them down with red wine, but which is nevertheless healthier, slimmer, and slightly longer lived than we are. What nutritionists fail to see in the French is a people with a completely different relationship to food than we have. They seldom snack, eat small portions from small plates, don't go back for second helpings, and eat most of their food at long, leisurely meals shared with other people. The rules governing these behaviors may matter more than any magic nutrient in their diet. The rules in this section are designed to foster a healthier relationship to food, whatever it is you're eating. Rule number 44. Pay more, eat less. With food, as with so many things, you get what you pay for. There is also a trade-off between quality and quantity, and a person's food experience, a meal's duration or quotient of pleasure, does not necessarily correlate with the number of calories consumed. The American food system has for many years devoted its energies to increasing quantity and reducing price rather than to improving quality. There's no escaping the fact that better food, measured by taste or nutritional quality, which often correspond, costs more because it has been grown or raised less intensively and with more care. Not everyone can afford to eat well in America, which is a literal shame, but most of us can. Americans spend less than 10% of their income on food, less than the citizens of any other nation. As the cost of food in America has declined in terms of both price and the effort required to put it on the table, we have been eating much more and spending more on healthcare. If you spend more for better food, you'll probably eat less of it and treat it with more care. And if that higher quality food tastes better, you will need less of it to feel satisfied. Choose quality over quantity, food experience over mere calories. Or, as grandmothers used to say, better to pay the grocer than the doctor. Rule number 45, eat less. This is probably the most unwelcome advice of all, but in fact, the scientific case for eating a lot less than we currently do, regardless of whether you are overweight, is compelling. Calorie restriction has repeatedly been shown to slow aging in animals, and many researchers believe it offers the single strongest link between diet and cancer prevention. We eat much more than our bodies need to be healthy, and the excess wreaks havoc, and not just on our weight. But we are not the first people in history to grapple with the special challenges posed by food abundance. And previous cultures have devised various ways to promote the idea of moderation. The rules that follow offer a few proven strategies. Rule number 46. Stop eating before you're full. Nowadays, we think it is normal and right to eat until you are full, but many cultures specifically advise stopping well before that point is reached. The Japanese have a saying, hara hachibu, counseling people to stop eating when they are 80% full. The Ayurvedic tradition in India advises eating until you are 75% full. The Chinese specify 70%, and the Prophet Muhammad described a full belly as one that contained one-third food and one-third liquid and one-third air, that is, nothing. Note the relatively narrow range specified in all this advice, somewhere between 67 and 80% of capacity. Take your pick. There's also a German expression that says, you need to tie off the sack before it gets completely full. And how many of us have grandparents who talk of leaving the table a little bit hungry? Here again, the French may have something to teach us. To say I'm hungry in French, you say j'ai faim, I have hunger. And when you are finished, you do not say that you were full, but je n'ai plus faim, I have no more hunger. That is a completely different way of thinking about satiety. So ask yourself not, am I full, but is my hunger gone? That moment will arrive several bites sooner. Rule number 47. Eat when you are hungry, not when you are bored. For many of us, eating has surprisingly little to do with hunger. We eat out of boredom, for entertainment, to comfort or reward ourselves. Try to be aware of why you're eating and ask yourself if you're really hungry before you eat and then again along the way. One old wives' test, if you're not hungry enough to eat an apple, then you're not hungry. Food is a costly antidepressant. Rule number 48, consult your gut. Most of us allow external and usually visual cues to determine how much we eat. The larger the portion, for example, the more we eat. The bigger the container, the more we pour. As in so many areas of modern life, the culture of food has become a culture of the eye. But when it comes to food, it pays to cultivate the other senses, which often provide more useful and accurate information. It can take 20 minutes before your brain gets the word that your belly is full. That means if you take less than 20 minutes to finish a meal, the sensation of satiety will arrive too late to be of any use. So slow down and pay attention to what your body, and not just your sense of sight, is telling you. This is what your grandparents were getting at with the adage, "Your eyes are bigger than your stomach." Rule number 49. Eat slowly. Not just so you'll be more likely to know when to stop, eat slowly enough to savor your food. You'll need less of it to feel satisfied. If it is a food experience, rather than mere calories you're after, the slower you eat, the more of an experience you will have. There is an Indian proverb that gets at this idea. Drink your food, chew your drink. In other words, eat slowly enough and chew thoroughly enough to liquefy your food, and move your drink around in your mouth to thoroughly taste it before swallowing. The recommendation sounds a bit clinical, perhaps, but try following it at least to the point of fully appreciating what's in your mouth. Another strategy, encoded in a table manner that's been all but forgotten, put down your fork between bites. Rule number 50. The banquet is in the first bite. Taking this adage to heart will help you enjoy your food and eat more slowly. No other bite will taste as good as the first, and every subsequent bite will progressively diminish in satisfaction. Economists call this the law of diminishing marginal utility, and it argues for savoring the first few bites and stopping sooner than you otherwise might. For as you go on, you'll be getting more calories, but not necessarily more pleasure. Rule number 51. Spend as much time enjoying the meal as it took to prepare it. This is a pretty good metric that honors the cook for the care you or he or she has put into the meal at the same time that it helps you to slow down and savor it. Rule number 52. Buy smaller plates and glasses. The bigger the portion, the more we will eat, upwards of 30% more. Food marketers know this, so they supersize our portions as a way to get us to buy more. But we don't have to supersize portions at home and shouldn't. One researcher found that simply switching from a 12-inch to a 10-inch dinner plate caused people to reduce their consumption by 22%. Rule number 53. Serve a proper portion and don't go back for seconds. You lose all control over portion size when you have second helpings. So what is a proper portion? There is folklore offering some sensible rules of thumb based on your size. One adage says you should never eat a portion of animal protein bigger than your fist. Another says that you should eat no more food at a meal than would fit into the bowl formed by your hands when cupped together. If you are going to break the rule on seconds, at least wait several minutes before doing it. You may well discover that you don't really need seconds, or if you do, not as much as you thought. Rule number 54. Breakfast like a king, lunch like a prince, dinner like a pauper. Eating a big meal late in the day sounds unhealthy, though in fact the science isn't conclusive. Some research suggests that eating close to bedtime elevates triglyceride levels in the blood, a marker for heart disease that is also implicated in weight gain. Also, the more physically active you are after a meal, the more of the energy in that meal your muscles will burn before your body stores it as fat. But some researchers believe a calorie is a calorie no matter what time of day it is consumed. Even if this is true, however, front-loading your eating in the early part of the day will probably result in fewer total calories consumed, since people are generally less hungry in the morning. A related adage, after lunch, sleep a while. After dinner, walk a mile. Rule number 55, eat meals. This recommendation sounds almost as ridiculous as eat food, but nowadays it too no longer goes without saying. We are snacking more and eating fewer meals together. Sociologists and market researchers who study American eating habits no longer organize their results around the increasingly quaint concept of the meal. They now measure eating occasions and report that we have added to the traditional big three, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, an as yet untitled fourth daily eating occasion that lasts all day long. The constant sipping and snacking we do while watching TV, driving, working, and so on. One study found that among Americans ages 18 to 50, nearly a fifth of all eating takes place in the car. In theory, grazing, eating 5 or 6 small meals over the course of the day, makes sense, but in practice, people eating this way often end up eating more and eating more processed snack foods. So unless you can confine your grazing to real food, stick to meals. Rule number 56. Limit your snacks to unprocessed plant foods. Remember the old taboo against between-meal snacks? Decades of determined food marketing have driven the phrase from our consciousness. But the bulk of the 500 calories Americans have added to their daily diet since 1980, the start of the obesity epidemic, have come in the form of snack foods laden with salt, fat, and sugar. If you are going to snack, try to limit yourself to fruits, vegetables, and nuts. Rule number 57. Don't get your fuel from the same place your car does. American gas stations now make more money inside selling food and cigarettes than they do outside selling gasoline. But consider what kind of food this is. Except perhaps for the milk and water, it's all highly processed, imperishable snack foods and extravagantly sweetened soft drinks in hefty 20-ounce bottles. Gas stations have become processed corn stations, ethanol outside for your car, and high fructose corn syrup inside for you. Don't eat here. Rule number 58. Do all your eating at a table. No, a desk is not a table. If we eat while we're working or while watching TV or driving, we eat mindlessly, and as a result, eat a lot more than we would if we were eating at a table, paying attention to what we're doing. This phenomenon can be tested and put to good use. Place a child in front of a television set and place a bowl of fresh vegetables in front of him or her. The child will eat everything in the bowl, often even vegetables he or she doesn't ordinarily touch, without noticing what's going on, which suggests an exception to the rule. When eating somewhere other than at a table, stick to fruits and vegetables. Rule number 59. Try not to eat alone. Americans are increasingly eating in solitude. Although there is some research to suggest that light eaters will eat more when they dine with others, perhaps because they spend more time at the table, for people prone to overeating, communal meals tend to limit consumption, if only because we're less likely to stuff ourselves when others are watching. We also tend to eat more slowly, since there's usually more going on at the table than ingestion. This is precisely why so much food marketing is designed to encourage us to eat in front of the TV or in the car. When we eat alone, we eat more. But regulating appetite is only part of the story. The shared meal elevates eating from a biological process of fueling the body to a ritual of family and community. Rule number 60. Treat treats as treats. There is nothing wrong with special occasion foods, as long as every day is not a special occasion. This is another case where the outsourcing of our food preparation to corporations has gotten us into trouble. It's made formerly expensive or time-consuming foods, everything from fried chicken and French fries to pastries and ice cream, easy and readily accessible. Frying chicken is so much trouble that people didn't used to make it unless they had guests coming over and a lot of time to prepare. The amount of work involved kept the frequency of indulgence in check. These special occasion foods offer some of the great pleasures of life, so we shouldn't deprive ourselves of them, but the sense of occasion needs to be restored. One way is to start making these foods yourself. If you bake dessert yourself, you won't go to that much trouble every day. Another is to limit your consumption of such foods to weekends or social occasions. Some people follow a so-called S policy. No snacks, no seconds, no sweets, except on days that begin with the letter S. Rule number 61. Leave something on your plate. Many of us were told by our parents while growing up that we should always clean our plates, an instruction that in later life we have perhaps taken a little too much to heart. But there is an older and healthier tradition that holds it is more genteel not to finish every last morsel of food. Leave something for Mr. Manners, some children once were told, or better to go to waste than to your waste. Practice not cleaning your plate. It will help you eat less in the short term and develop self-control in the long. Rule number 62. Plant a vegetable garden if you have the space, a window box if you don't. What does growing some of your own food have to do with repairing your relationship to food and eating? Everything. To take part in the intricate and endlessly interesting processes of providing for your sustenance is the surest way to escape the culture of fast food and the values implicit in it. That food should be fast, cheap, and easy. That food is a product of industry, not nature. That food is fuel rather than a form of communion with other people, and also with other species, with nature. On a more practical level, you will eat what your garden yields, which will be the freshest, most nutritious produce obtainable. You will get exercise growing it and get outdoors and away from screens. You will save money. According to the National Gardening Association, a $70 investment in a vegetable garden will yield $600 worth of food, and you will be that much more likely to follow the next all-important rule. Rule number 63. Cook. In theory, it should make little difference to your health whether you cook for yourself or let someone else do the work. But unless you can afford to hire a private chef to prepare meals exactly to your specifications, letting other people cook for you means losing control over your eating life, the portions as much as the ingredients. Cooking for yourself is the only sure way to take back control of your diet from the food scientists and food processors and to guarantee you're eating real food and not edible food-like substances with their unhealthy oils, high fructose corn syrup, and surfeit of salt. Not surprisingly, the decline in home cooking closely parallels the rise in obesity, and research suggests that people who cook are more likely to eat a more healthful diet. Rule number 64. Break the rules once in a while. Obsessing over food rules is bad for your happiness and probably for your health too. Our experience over the past few decades suggests that dieting and worrying too much about nutrition has made us no healthier or slimmer. Cultivating a relaxed attitude toward food is important. There will be special occasions when you will want to throw these rules out the window. All will not be lost, especially if you don't throw out rule number 60, treat treats as treats. What matters is not the special occasion, but the everyday practice, the default habits that govern your eating on a typical day. All things in moderation, it is often said, but we should never forget Oscar Wilde's wise addendum, including moderation. Acknowledgements. I want to thank all the people who helped in the writing of this book, many of whom I don't know by name, and many of whom don't even know they've helped, but several I'm happy to be able to acknowledge by name. David Ludwig, MD, read the manuscript and made many valuable suggestions. He also caught several errors, though he shouldn't be held responsible for any that remain. He has been an invaluable teacher on questions of nutrition. So has Daphne Miller, MD, who contributed several memorable rules drawn from her medical practice and extensive field work on traditional diets around the world. I've also learned a lot about diet and health from my conversations with Marion Nessel, Walter Willett, and Joan Gussow, even though I'm sure each will find things to disagree with in this book. Special thanks to Tara Parker Pope at the New York Times for letting me solicit rules on her blog, and to her readers, whose overwhelming response enriched the project immeasurably. My old friend and colleague Michael Schwartz read the manuscript and improved it with his editing. Thank you once again. Thanks again, too, to Amanda Urban and her crack team at ICM, and to the wonderful crew at Penguin, but especially to Anne Godoff, Lindsay Whalen, Holly Watson, and Rachel Bird. For her first-rate research and editing, I'm grateful to Malia Wallen. Adrian Davich also contributed valuable research and fact-checking. And finally, heartfelt thanks to Judith and Isaac, the best dinner companions anyone could wish for. Your ideas and words, not to mention your cooking, always nourish me and particularly nourished this book. This is Michael Pollan. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Food Rules, an Eater's Manual. This program was directed by Mary Diltz, executive producer Diane McKiernan. Text copyright 2009 by Michael Pollan. Production copyright 2020, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.